Welcome back to Inside the Bar, Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. I'm Christy Barker, a 25-year veteran of the Chatham County District Attorney's Office. I wanted to close this series on the murder of Lauren Brown by having Sergeant Chris Ross back to explain how hard Lauren struggled with leaving Norman Smart. The timeline that led to her death shows that she tried to leave again and again, but just couldn't see a safe exit. For Lauren, the place she should have been safest was the least safe space, her home. And welcome back to Inside the Bar Beyond a Reasonable Doubt. This is Christy Barker, and I am really, really grateful that Chris Ross is willing to come back and talk with me. I'm hoping to drag him back a couple more times on other cases, but I do want to finish up talking about Norman Smart because of the amazing work that you did. And the last time you were here, there were some things that I really didn't touch on that I kind of wanted to get back to and just kind of give a timeline of how Lauren's relationship with Norman developed. Mm-hmm. So by the time Norman killed Lauren, how long, to your recollection, had they been together?
It was a few years. I don't know the exact number.
Okay.
But it was a few years because even the family had given us information during the initial investigation that he had separated her from them and they were estranged for a while.
Okay. And that estrangement happened over time, right?
Yeah, it was. I think in the beginning, the way it was explained to me was they met him and they had a few family things, and then all of a sudden it just stopped. I know it was over a period of time, but it was a short period of time in the beginning of their relationship. And it was one of those things where probably. Just for an example, I don't want to use any of this family as an example, but just as an example, if like a father didn't like somebody and said, "I don't want you seeing him," and then there was that rebellious act of, "I don't care what you say," and all of a sudden that became the culmination of him being able to completely isolate her from anyone or anybody.
All right. Very early on, it sounded like she was kind of swept off her feet by him a little bit.
Oh, she was. He was probably pretty charismatic in the beginning, you know.
Right. And, I got the sense that, he was very attentive and all of those kinds of things early. And she kind of, pulled back. You describe her pulling back from family, I think. There reached a point where maybe the only family members she had contact with were her brother and
her cousin.
Mm-hmm. And even they backed off a whole bunch.
Yeah. Well, they didn't, from talking to them, they weren't welcome by him by any means. They did have the disconnect and dysfunction between those individuals with her. Because I think the fear was for him, as in Norman, was that they would talk her into leaving at some point in that relationship, because they had their own thought process about what may be going on there, not to mention what she had told them throughout the history of that relationship.
Right, and I remember, and again, I'm going on memory of what happened at trial. I remember her cousin testifying, and there was an incident, maybe the October before she was killed, so maybe like 9 months or so before, where they had been at Kylie's house. Do you remember this?
I think I remember a snippet of that where somebody got jealous and there was either a altercation or a verbal argument about what had happened and they left. I do remember it vaguely.
I think there was... the thing that stuck out to me is there was some sort of electronic contact after that. Like, Facebook Messenger or text or something where he was pretending to be Lauren.
Yes, there was a lot of that.
And so, if I remember right, and you might remember this better than I do, there was the way they figured it out that it was actually him is, you know, he started saying things like, you know, I'm going to kill you and mm-hmm. stuff like that.
I think that, you know, when I interviewed different family members, they would, especially the cousin, she would ask questions. Like if she received a text, she would ask a question that only she or Lauren may know the answer to and wouldn't get the response that she needed. And she would always think, that's not her.
Which is scary. You know, and she, Kylie and Lauren, how would you describe their relationship from what you learned?
It was close before Norman got in the picture.
I mean, they were like sisters, really.
Yeah.
Lived together, had kids, yep. You know, had apartments and stuff as adults.
Kids played together. Well, it was, and that would have been before the youngest child. But with that being said, yeah, they were close.
And when Lauren's youngest child was born, I think that everybody was very isolated, if I remember right.
At that point, I would think so.
Yeah.
I think that Lauren's family told me they had may have met, seen him 2 or 3 times.
And he was turning 2.
Right.
And it's not like they weren't in town.
Right. I mean, they were 10 miles away.
And it's not like they didn't want to see.
Yeah.
So this really kind of deteriorated. And it deteriorated not just the isolation from the family, but there was money involved as well. Do you recall, like, they had gone from being pretty stable with jobs and then they had this landscape business. And do you remember some things about the landscape business and the guy they worked with, things that would happen between Lauren and Norman that this guy had seen?
I don't recall. I know that they had some financial ups and downs through that landscape business. If I remember correctly, but I don't remember anybody else. I knew that they had an employee at one point, but I can't call right off the top of my head.
And the reason I'm remembering it is I remember his describing Lauren wearing sunglasses at night at her house.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I do remember that. Where he... I think when everything was said and done, he knew that something was going on, but didn't know how to address it type thing. But yeah, that was one of the things that he said, that, like you just said, she would wear sunglasses at night, or when she went out in public, she would dress a certain way to cover parts of her body that wouldn't normally be covered, say, in the middle of summer type thing. But yeah, I do recall that.
Well, and I think there was also an injury to her. I mean, I'm not just talking about an injury to her, but there was damage to walls in the house, things like that, that other people had seen. And you saw some of that when mm-hmm. you were there, too. Do you remember where those things were?
Well, they had I'm putting myself back in the house here. they had a garage that had been converted to a room, and there was damage on a door in that garage. There was damage to the front door that wasn't related to her murder. It was brought up, but it wasn't actually related to it.
How do you know that?
Because there was a chain slide lock that was on that door at some point, and it was found in a drawer. After the fact, photographs were taken of it, and because one of the defenses he had was somebody broke in the house, and it was obvious that if they had, somebody had to pick that up and put it in a drawer. So that wasn't plausible at that point.
Well, it didn't look like recent damage, if I remember the
right,
pictures
and it,
right.
And it didn't. But it was just little things like that.
I seem to remember like a hole in the wall or something, you know, like
yeah,
something
was,
that had been a punch
in
the wall or something.
There was
like
a hole
that.
In the wall, and
that
there
was in the hallway.
It was in the hallway.
Okay.
But there was damage throughout the house in different little increment spots, but the hole in the wall was obvious. The
because that was at like shoulder height. It
right.
Was, it, yeah.
And I mean, you could tell that. It, like I said the last time we spoke, it was a very weird crime scene because when we walked in, I mean, it was pristine, it was clean. And that's just uncommon. That's not, obviously it's not unheard of, but it is uncommon. And, but there were stuff that was indicative of violence, I'll put it that way, or domestic violence.
Well, and that perfectionism.
Mm-hmm.
And you're very familiar, obviously, with the patterns of domestic violence, that perfectionism, trying to cover it up, trying to hide it by being perfect to the outside
right.
world.
I mean, there was a statement made during this case that the first one that calls 911 wins.
I had forgotten about that. That was something that was said to his ex-wife. His mother said that to her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. But you are very familiar, obviously, with these patterns of domestic violence,
mm-hmm.
and I, you know, I've been trained on it and have had seen a fair number of cases. What we've been told is that the most dangerous time in a relation, domestic violence relationship, is when they're trying to leave.
That's right.
Was there evidence in this case
yes.
that Lauren had tried to leave?
Yep, multiple times.
Okay, and what do you remember about that?
At one point, she left prior to the incident. It was a few months prior to the incident. She went to a family member or a friend, but she went and stayed at an apartment behind one of her friend's houses for a short period of time, trying to break that cycle and get away. And he actually went there and got her. And
if I remember it, like, he'd beaten her with the suitcases she was
yep.
trying to leave with?
Yep, he did. And I think that was... And when he picked her up, there was an incident at that house where he had put her hands on her, and they actually confronted him before they left.
And I think she went to that same friend's house maybe a week, 10 days before she was killed, if I
yes.
remember right.
Yes. They had... She had attempted multiple times to break away or even break the cycle. I think she was at a point where she was so isolated, she had no money to run, she didn't know who to reach out to. She didn't, and honestly, I think he put it in her head. She didn't know if she could call her family. She didn't know what she could do. And, you know, throughout this case, every single person I spoke to in Lauren's family said, if she had only called.
Yeah.
And that's true.
Yeah.
But when you're put in a position where you're under somebody's thumb, and they are in control of everything, you don't know what you can and can't do. You seem to forget that you have the freedom to do what you need to do without permission.
Yeah. And I think that what I recall, too, of that most recent attempt to leave right before she was killed, she'd gone to the friend's house. They were going to, you know, call the police in the morning.
Yep, and I think she left before the next morning. She, if I remember correctly, she went there, she stayed, she went to sleep, or at least that's what...
She had the kids with her, didn't
yeah.
she? Yeah.
She stayed, she went to sleep, and she left before the next morning, so she didn't have to call. It is the way I understood it.
Yeah, and my recollection is, like, there was a note, like, I can't do this to you, I can't
right.
put you in danger kind of thing. I really feel like she was trying so hard to protect everybody else
right.
from him. Like, she could stand in the way and stop him.
I could agree with that. I mean, and in the end, with the event the way it happened, she tried.
This is so heartbreaking. And I want to talk about, too, like a little bit of the timeline of the day, because you reconstructed this.
Oh, yeah.
And even in reconstructing that day that led up to her being killed, there was evidence that he was abusing her.
Well, there was evidence that the night before the call, before the police were called, there was an argument. And it had spilled over from inside to outside, back to inside. And that's from witnesses that either heard it or observed it even.
Well, they had like delivery people there that day, right?
Right. Throughout that first, that day, yes, there was a delivery maid. And after speaking with them, they even said that, you know, they knew something was wrong, but they didn't know what it was, if that makes any sense. Yeah, which would be, that's indicative of that relationship in that house, you know, mind your own business type thing. But they even said they knew something was wrong. They just did, they don't know to intervene or to do anything. They were there delivering an appliance, and they delivered it and went on their way.
But if I agree with you. I do think that they, you know, they didn't know all of what they were saying and didn't want to make some sort of report out of context or whatever.
Well, I don't think they knew the extent.
Right. But I think he said something like, I'm going to put my hands on this bitch or something like that in front of them.
Yeah, he did say something to that effect. I don't remember exactly what it was, but he did say something to the effect of physically harming Lauren, which that's what perked their ears up. And actually, when they were contacted after this murder, they brought that up.
Yeah, it wasn't but, like you knew that that was there.
No, they actually said, well, while we were there, this was said. Well, why didn't you do something? You know, well, he didn't, type thing.
Well, and it's, yeah, I think it's the same thing, and I remember her friends that she had gone to stay with saying, you know, why, asking that question, why didn't you call the police? And she didn't want them to.
Right.
I think she thought it was going to make it worse.
Right, and I think she did think it was going to make it worse, and we have letters that prove that.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, you know, there's a lot of people right now that beat themselves up because they didn't do something.
Yeah.
And everybody can understand a person's need to be private or need to not have an intervention based on their behalf because of whatever. But, you know, there's always that what if, what if, what if. And I know these folks ask themselves every day, what if. But Lauren made the choices she made not only to try to protect herself, but to protect her children and everybody around her. Because in her mind, we know, as a prosecutor and as a detective, we know how dangerous this man is and how dangerous he was. And, you know, Lauren knew.
Yeah.
She knew how dangerous he was. And she didn't want to subject anybody else to that. Not her daddy, not her mama, not her family, not her kids, of course. But she didn't know how to get out. And that's the unfortunate part of domestic violence, is that people are taught after they get involved with this that that's the way somebody loves you, and that is not the case. That's not true.
Right, that my love is pain.
Right, and they, exactly. and that's just, I don't want to call anybody to the carpet in regards to that, because if anybody's out there and they need help, I want them to ask for it. But you cannot, if you live in fear because of a situation like this, be less afraid of the rest of the world and be very afraid of your house and leave.
Right. The safe place isn't safe.
Right. It's one of those things where you just got to make up your mind and do it. And you are strong enough.
Yeah.
There were plenty of people, and if I had seen Lauren the day before this happened, I would have said, you are strong enough, let's go.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
but you got there the day after.
Right.
And so, I keep trying to get back to this timeline, but it's just so hard because there's so much to it.
Well, I think we started talking a few minutes ago about the incident the night of or before.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a lot of things that happened that night.
Mm-hmm.
Neighbor actually saw some interaction that they weren't comfortable with. They didn't call the police, but they were like, this happens all the time type thing.
And it was part of the argument, right?
Right. And then there was a friend came over and dropped off some stuff at the request of Lauren.
Right.
And they actually tried to get her to go right then, say, get in the car, let's go.
Yeah.
And she wouldn't go.
Right. And my recollection, you know, you talked about this fight, and I think we talked about it a little bit as far as how we know the fight went.
Mm-hmm.
She could not leave that house.
Right, because he had slashed all the tires on her car.
And thrown her keys in the bushes.
Right.
And so she calls a friend, and she's like, just get me a little airplane bottle. I think she had like a dollar or
right.
something to give her friend for an airplane bottle.
Right.
Like a,
and that was more than one, but it was a few airplane bottles. But,
well, we found a few.
Yeah. And but yeah, she had asked her to bring over alcohol, and I'm sure that was to ease the pain of what was happening.
But I do, and I agree with you. I remember the testimony of her friend. I think her name is Miranda Self, if I'm remembering right. That she's sitting on this dark road.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she pulled into the driveway and she's trying to get her to leave, and Lauren looks up and sees headlights.
And says,
and
you gotta go.
You gotta go. That could be him.
That
you gotta go.
Him. Yep.
And she was terrified.
Yep.
And you know, so much of this, and it wasn't, you have this he said, she said situation in any domestic violence case. One of the things that really helped us was confirming and corroborating everything these folks told us
mm-hmm.
through the electronic messages.
Yep.
Right?
And there was a bunch of them.
And and you could see there was a text fight that night.
Oh, yes.
Do you remember some of the things he was saying? Because I remember them vividly. And
well,
so
I don't know them word for word, but I know she called him a few explicitives and said some things that somebody loves, somebody wouldn't say to somebody. but
he may have earned those.
Yeah. But they pretty much were calling each other out. And I think that it was at the point where, honestly, and this is my opinion, if Lauren had known how to leave with her children that day, based on those messages, she probably would have. And I think it was to the point where even her friend pulled up and said, just come on. And she said, I can't do it because of those children.
Right.
And I think one of those things is, in one of the letters, it was something to the effect of, they deserve a father. Things of that nature. You don't want to break the bond between a father and their son and this, that, and the other. And that's just not the case.
Right.
But I think that was her biggest.
Well, she was getting brainwashed some too.
Right.
Because
right.
when I looked at those text messages, and we got those phone dumps, shortly before trial,
mm-hmm.
and I remember looking at them, and I remember being shocked at how far back they went and how many were from his mother. And the tone of them, there were like Bible verses she was quoting. And, we talked about it being kind of a cult.
Yep.
But there was a lot of that kind of language in it, too. You know, a father needs to, show his children how to
yep.
be a man. And, there were things about, like, animal imagery and just, this kind of...
And it was. But I think that, getting back to that, there was a lot of that. His family was very involved in regards to what was happening in their marriage in that house,
mm-hmm.
Where hers was not.
Right.
So all the input to her was coming from his side.
Right.
And she had no outside influence playing into her or anything of that nature. And there's a lot of and we're talking about Lauren and today and that day and leading up to that day, but there's a lot of history that we looked into this case that over and over and over proved the cycle of violence that this man had in him for years, not just for this moment in time or just this relationship. It was years. And throughout all of that, the people that were involved were his family in regards to that. And, you know, I'm not going to talk ill of anybody.
But, you're a good man.
But, you know,
I might.
I get it. But, you know, at some point as a man, you got to draw the line in the sand somewhere and say, I don't need your advice or whatever when it comes to your relationship or your time with somebody or this, that, kind of. But yeah, I mean, she was brainwashed, but that was taught to him.
Well, and you know, again, you mentioned like how far back that went. I remember looking at those text messages, and there were text messages from his mom and his sister to him,
right?
Too, and I can't remember exactly the time frame. It was within 6 months of the murder, where his sister texts something like, "You got to stop putting your hands on her. You might accidentally kill her."
Yep. And that wasn't just one time, that was multiple times.
Right.
And there were multiple text messages about the violence that occurred there over and over and over.
Right. And even the night of, and he went to the bar, right? He slashes her tires, throws her keys in the bushes, and goes to the bar. And that night there are text messages where he's talking about, oh, you've got to feel the power.
Right.
Like, he's all about his physical strength.
Yep.
And you know, based on, and there were text messages in his phone, too, where he's, like, picking up on another woman or, you know, just kind of, you know.
I think he was very antagonistic toward her when it comes to that, you know.
How do you mean?
Like, you want me to love you? You stay here. I'm going to go here and do this.
Yeah.
You know, that would make anybody angry. Especially if you stop somebody's movement. Because I think that if I remember correctly, before he slashed the tires, she was simply going to go somewhere to, like a grocery store or something, to get something for one of those kids.
Yeah, something to eat or
yeah, it was something.
Cough medicine or something.
Yeah. And he just said no and slashed the tires and left. Now, there was an argument, of course, in the yard during all that, and but for whatever reason, people, I don't want to get involved, they take the blind eye and they don't call the police, even though they saw it, they saw what happened, they know what was happening. They just they don't want to be the ones that he looks at after the fact and goes, "You're the one that called."
Yeah, they well, and we hear it so often. You see something, say something, right? Mm-hmm.
And but that's the thing. People got to understand, too, if you see something in a grocery store, if you see something in your front yard, if you see something walking down the street, it does not matter where you are, you can call the police. They will go look into it, and then they will determine what needs to be done. And not that it's good, bad, or indifferent. It may have been a fluke, but at least we'll know.
Right. But, yeah, that you know, there were a whole lot of people that either didn't know how or didn't take the initiative.
And that's the biggest takeaway for me in this.
What?
Is this particular case can be used over and over and over again to educate people on what not to do when it comes to domestic violence.
Yeah.
And because more cases than not, and I'm not taking away from Lauren's case, but more cases than not lead to this exact moment in time when someone loses their life, and it shouldn't.
No.
And in the prosecution, you said it best in a closing argument when you said the man that's supposed to love her the most killed her.
I think that was Jenny's close.
Well, one of you said it.
Well, she said it, and the way I remember, and I just remember her, because I've never heard her curse in a closing.
Yeah.
He beat the hell out of her, and she yelled it.
Yep.
And I remember when she sat down, because, you know, when the three of us are sitting at the table, she was shaking.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is that kind of case.
And it was.
It is. It is to this day. And I do want to talk about one of the features of these text messages
mm-hmm.
that we noticed, and it just made me livid.
Yep.
What am I talking about?
He deleted them all. He deleted every text message.
Out of both of their phones.
Yep, out of both their phones. And
I did argue about that.
I don't want to give away our techniques, but just because you delete something doesn't mean it's gone.
Right.
And but
it was marked, like, when you look at the records, there's a thing deleted yes or no, and it was all why, yes.
Yeah, it clearly, when we're able to obtain evidence from a digital device, it clearly tells us whether or not it's deleted or not. And everything related up unto that day before was deleted in both their phones.
And
including the text message we were just talking about where he was at the bar.
Right.
Because I remember you made me read them out loud.
And does it say yes? Well, I think actually Jenny handled you on this day. But I do remember saying to both of you, because I was so mad, you need to make sure you say this.
Yep.
Because that's what I do. I'm kind of a pest.
Yep.
But I do remember, I did argue that in closing. Like, who on earth do you think Lauren had the time while she was being beaten to delete these messages out
that's
of her phone or out of Norman's phone? I mean, that told me how much time he had to think about it afterwards.
Oh, he had a ton of time.
I'm 100% certain he called his mother.
Oh, yeah. I have no doubt in my mind. We have the phone records.
But, you know, that's one of those things they keep talking about. It's like, oh, you know, that they're making this whole thing up. It's like, no. None of it was made up. None of it.
This case, you know, it changed a lot of people. It changed a lot of perception about domestic violence within agencies, within the state.
How do you mean?
Well, there was a lot of stuff done on the case that we would not have normally done. Yeah, and I know you're aware of that.
But our listeners aren't, so go ahead.
Well, you know, when coming from my background and throughout my career, when you go into a situation like this, you know this is not the first time, you know. And so I went digging, you know. And the more I dug, the deeper the hole got, and the more stuff I found out. And it went way back. And we were able to take that information that we obtained from a long time ago that hurt other people, not just Lauren, and bring that to the forefront and say, look, this is not the first time he's done this. You know, this first time he killed somebody that we know of, but it's not the first time he hurt somebody in a domestic violence situation. And we were able to bring that that light to bear on him. And I think, if I'm not, I don't want to misquote the law, okay, because I'm not a lawyer, but I think we made case law on this case.
We did.
And it changed the way we use 404B evidence. So that's a good thing.
It is. And it was really, I think, part of my function in this trial, or the preliminary motions and stuff. I tend to be a heavy researcher. And we had, at the time this case was tried in 2014, we had very recently had a change to the rules of evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And so 404B evidence was handled differently. The letters to God, which used to be something we would call res justi, or, you know, a form of hearsay, and we had to figure out how to get them in. So those two parts of this case were case law that needed to be made, because there wasn't any
right
under these new rules. And so when this case came up for appeal, Lindsay Rutter, who I absolutely love, drafted the initial brief, but I went back through it because there were so many very specific facts to this case that if you didn't try it, you don't know. And Lindsay's an appeal person. So, you know, I was sitting in the courtroom and I saw it. And of course I argued, Jenny argued the 404B pretrial. I argued the letters to God, the 807. And I think we made a really good record, and apparently the Supreme Court agreed, Georgia Supreme Court agreed. And that is the seminal case in Georgia, especially on domestic violence and the admissibility of 404B evidence. And it was cited a couple weeks ago in a Georgia Supreme Court case. So it is still the law, it is good law, and it's going to continue to be good law because it's solid.
Well, that's a good thing.
It is a good thing. It is a good thing.
Because it gives law enforcement just another avenue to...
Right. And for those of you who don't know what 404B is, and I sit here rattling off legal terms, we're talking about similar transactions. We're talking about prior difficulties, and particularly prior difficulties between domestic violence partners. And so for that evidence to come in, there are some hoops you have to jump through. And that evidence is really powerful.
Yeah.
It is really powerful.
It can be eye-opening for attorneys or juries.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. And I remember arguing this with the Georgia Supreme Court, and I remember how fascinated they were, because it was the first time I had ever used any kind of visual anything with the Supreme Court. Generally, you can just go up and you say, this is law, and I actually went. And I brought with me Dr. Down's slide of the Winster chest, and those justices were just fascinated. Just fascinated. Because sometimes I just don't think they look at the exhibits. I don't think they look at the visceral elements to a case. They have so many. And to get their attention...
Mm-hmm.
And draw it to this, that the opinion is really well written too, is, you know, being domestic violence, why a spouse, and I think this language is in there, why would a spouse hurt another spouse? That is a motive that needs to be explained, and that's part of the reason that this is admissible, is to show that intention to harm another spouse. And so that is really... it shows that we got the message across.
That's good. I can't give y'all enough accolades. I can.
I'm not looking for accolades. I'm
just saying. I sat through this trial. I worked this case, and I sat through the trial, and you know, even at the end of the trial, and I know all of us were sitting there like, you know, here we are, and but that's one day. That one day when that jury came back, I will never forget that.
No.
So.
No, I won't either. And he is exactly where he needs to be.
Oh, absolutely.
But you know, as you know, the case never ends.
Yeah, and I'm aware.
Right, and you know, I've talked about this. He's filed more stuff, and you know,
as a law enforcement officer, I see it differently than lawyers in general. But if, you know, if I arrest you, you're guilty.
You know? You've done your job, right?
And but the law is the law. And the unfortunate part about people that, or any murderer for that matter, and I understand that they have rights, okay? But if you murder somebody and you're found guilty, as far as I'm concerned, you need to be where they put you. And
well, I'm wearing my t-shirt.
Yes, you are.
I'm wearing my Chris Ross t-shirt. So because we don't have visuals, I kind of have to describe this.
That was a different case.
It was a different case. But it says everything we need to know about Chris Ross. And we're going to talk about that case at some point, because it's one of Allie's cases. So what does my shirt say, Chris Ross?
let me get it right. We are the fucking murder police, and we lock people up for fucking life.
And that is the much more gentle way of saying the way you said it.
Ladies and gentlemen, I actually said that in an interview.
It did not come out with that kind of delivery in that interview, as I recall.
It did not. I love that shirt, by the way.
I do too. This is the best.
During a trial of that particular case, some folks were kind enough to make this t-shirt and passed it out among us.
It is the best. We tried that, the second defendant in that case, shortly before our summer conference. And so I brought my murder police t-shirt to our summer conference. And I got in trouble for wearing this at a prosecutor's conference.
I was
very upset. But I guess some people have sensitive ears or something.
Yeah.
So. But I love it. You're the fucking murder police, Chris Ross, and I am so grateful. So grateful that you are.
All right.
Well,
forward.
Yeah. So do you think we need to tell anybody anything else about this, or are we good?
I think that at the end of the day, Lauren died a very senseless death, okay, that she didn't deserve. Her family didn't deserve it. Her children certainly didn't deserve it. And when you work a case like this, and I'm going to say this, and I'm going to put it in perspective for anybody in this situation, for anybody that's dealing with this, for anybody on the other side, for anybody committing the violence. When a woman, a small woman at that, begs for her life in front of her two children, begs, and he doesn't relent, I'm going to say exactly what Kylie said. He can rot in hell.
Lauren's story is such a tragedy, but it is one that plays out every day in homes across all socioeconomic boundaries. Lauren was a well-educated, intelligent woman who followed her heart into a world of isolation and terror. My hope is that sharing her story can help people that feel trapped in these kinds of relationships to get help. Call the police. Contact Safe Shelter. For those who witness abuse, call. If you see something, say something. There is a way out. Our next series will look at a different form of evil. Norman Smart is a deliberate, calculated type of violence, one whose evil knows no bounds with the people he claims to love. There are other forms of evil at work in Savannah, though. The murders of Kiana Marshall, Corey Marshall, and Alexis Kitchens by James Hampton and Dwayne Abney reveal a subculture of violence that is spontaneous, impulsive, and seems to glory in the chaos it creates. It also shows how interconnected and ultimately destructive some shootings are in a place like Savannah. Join us in a month as we explore this underworld that leaves so many living in fear.